I'm speaking today with Ginger Siegel and Bob Kupinick of Operation Homestead, which was a movement in Seattle from the late 1980s to the early 1990s. And Ginger and Bob, do you want to tell us a little bit about the organizing work of Operation Homestead and how you got involved?
Sure, I'll start. Operation Homestead was a group of activists, social service providers, religious leaders, and homeless people that came together in Seattle in about 1987. So at that time, there was a significant increase in homelessness in Seattle, as across the country. And there was a really clear connection for us between buildings being emptied for development in downtown Seattle and the number of people living on the street. So it started as sort of a small group, mostly of sort of housing activists, young people, people that worked. There's a tenants union here, the Tenants Union of Washington State, whose main office is in Seattle. So there were staff members. I was a staff member of the tenant union. So there were staff members of that organization. But then there were also, there had been social services popping up to serve homeless people, like shelters and some healthcare providers. And a lot of those people also became involved. And there was, I think, a relatively significant church component. There were church leaders who had opened their basements to homeless people or had meal programs. And there was a lot of discontent that this problem was increasing and increasing, and there didn't seem to be any decent response to that on the part of the city. So this group of people got together and came up with sort of a simple philosophy, which was there are many vacant buildings, there are far too many vacant buildings, and there are lots and lots of homeless people, and we should just open those vacant buildings and let the homeless people live inside them.
I arrived in town in 1988, left school, and I was working as a carpenter, and I moved to Seattle, and I came across a flyer talking about tearing down the boards and opening up housing for homeless folks. At that point, there were a lot of vacant single-room apartments in the downtown core that were all boarded up. And, you know, in contrast to the number of people living on the streets, it sort of formulated its own question pretty obviously there. You know, the flyer just made a lot of sense to me, and as somebody who had some basic skills at building work and the idea of engaging homeless people to open up this housing, it just made sense.
And so how did you select buildings to occupy?
You know, over the course of the years, I think there were probably six different buildings. You know, as different people got involved in the organization, you know, I think a couple of things stepped forward. What was available, what buildings looked appropriate, what was visible and in an appropriate location, and frankly, what we could get our hands on. At the time, there had been a couple of ordinances that were passed in town that spoke to landlords' obligations to maintain their housing. There was the Downtown Housing Downtown Housing Maintenance Ordinance, and the Housing Preservation Ordinance. The DHMO spoke to a landlord's obligation to keep a building functional if it was practical to, right? Not to just hold on to it speculatively and tear it down when a better opportunity showed up. And so that was a reasonable, logical stepping off point for the organization. Like, this building's functional, there are people who need it, let's just tear down the boards and move in. And we, you know, clean this up and hold the landlord responsible for using it responsibly.
I guess I would add that we were not looking for just actions. We were not looking to tear down the boards, have the police show up, and be removed. That didn't happen most of the time. But we were looking at buildings that we could reasonably move people into quickly. So we weren't looking at buildings that were in just horrible shape. We were looking at buildings that could be made sort of reasonably habitable, but with our own work.
Sweat equity.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of the specific actions, some of the occupations, and some of the logistical problems that you might have encountered, some of the challenges?
Yeah. So I think the first most successful occupation was that of the Orion Court apartments, and that all of these had various levels of involvement of people on the street. Whoever came to the demonstration would get involved in most cases, and so that made it a little tricky to plan for, but it also gave a lot of really inspired energy to the actions. So the Orion Court, I remember a couple of the planning sessions where there had been previous takeovers, and somebody new to one of the meetings said, you know, well, what if they don't kick us out after a couple hours? And there was, I think, general laughter ensued after that. But in fact, we ended up staying there for 5 days. And figuring out what to do both with ourselves and with the building became a much richer conversation there. So people started off immediately pushing brooms and cleaning up the debris in the building, and in fact finding, I think, you know, functional dressers, beds in the rooms. They were somewhat furnished and usable. But then after a couple of days, you know, there wasn't power turned on, so we went to a rental facility around town, and we ended up borrowing a generator and an electrician stringing some lights to make the space safe, and people chipping in the skills that they had. And
we actually, I don't know if you remember this, but we actually passed the fire code inspection. Do you remember that?
Yes.
The fire department showed up and said, you can't be in here. It's not safe. And we said, well, what do we have to do? And they gave us a list of things. You know, you had to have exit signs, and I don't remember what they all were.
Yeah, some fire extinguishers and lights that stayed on all the time. And those, we ended up having a punch list that we were able to satisfy there. And then I think some real magic moments involved the people from the streets who got involved and sort of their energy and their pride in doing the cleanup and leading tours and having some knowledge about the actions. And city council members came down. I remember police officers coming around and checking things out. And there were rules that we had about, you know, safe conduct in the building, including no weapons. And one of the folks who was staying there informing the police that he had to leave his weapons at the door, which was soundly refused, but amused. You know, everyone was amused by the idea, and that's a very memorable moment.
Well, and it maybe raises the question of what is the relationship between Operation Homestead and kind of the some of that organizing energy that it helped mobilize, and you know, Seattle's really thriving tent city movement now with its self-governing philosophy. So that's, yeah, maybe not a conversation that we have time for today, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you see as some of the long-term contributions of the organizing work.
Well, that tent city group had its roots at the same time. I think they're very long-lived and come from the same seeds.
There are a lot of people that became politicized through Operation Homestead that then had careers, long either, you know, activism or professional careers in housing and homelessness in Seattle, and have had a big influence on services and policy in Seattle.
Can you talk a little bit about specific units that might have been preserved or other kind of gains in terms of actual housing units?
There were four major takeovers and two less major takeovers. We we got evicted quickly, and the movement was not quite as strong then. But there were four really significant ones, two of which we stayed in the building for quite a while, one for 5 days and one, I'm not sure how long the Pacific Hotel was.
I think that was somewhere around a week.
So of those four, three of the buildings were saved and renovated, purchased by nonprofits, and renovated with public money that was made available, at least partly, if not wholly, because of the political pressure around the activism and the takeover of the buildings.
Is that a specific agreement that in exchange for leaving, a certain number of units would be preserved?
No. We got evicted. So the ones we got evicted quickly from, you know, was very sort of unceremonious, like they were stronger than we, and that was the end of that.
But because of the clear message, the clear appropriate message to the obvious problem, it has resounding, it resonates with people, and there was a lot of public support. You know, I think many people articulated some of the dangers that were unleashed by moving a lot of homeless people into an ungoverned building. 24 hours a day for a series of days, and that is, I think, not to be minimized. But taking action, taking direct action to resolve an obvious and deep problem, I think it makes sense to people, and it resonated even after we were out of the building.
It sounds as if, you know, it really raised a lot of public awareness, and the fact that people were willing to go as far as they did in order to try to secure housing must have helped motivate a lot of other people to try to address the
issue. Yeah, I guess just to follow up on that and your question about exactly how were these gains achieved, what Bob was saying about the conversation that was created by this, the elevation in the public dialogue, the increase in the public conversation, and the amount of political pressure that was created set the stage to make it possible to save these buildings. And that felt good for the activist group that these buildings were saved. It wasn't a direct negotiation that we were involved in, but it would not have happened without us and would not have happened without the political pressure that we created. But then there was also benefits that we didn't even know about. Washington State has one of the healthiest housing trust funds in the country. That's a statewide funding program for low-income housing. And that was funded in 1991 in Olympia, in our legislature that, like Oregon, has, you know, we have pockets of conservatism in the state and we have pockets of liberalism in the state. But the trust fund was funded by the state legislature in 1991, and I think that is largely because of the political pressure that was created by the activism around abandonment and homelessness in Seattle.
Well, great. Thank you so much. I've been talking with Ginger Siegel and Bob Kubenik about Seattle's Operation Homestead. Thank you, and this has been Desiree Helligers with the Old Mole Variety Hour.